Good morning. Today is Tuesday, June 4th, 2019. This is part 6 oral history interview with Bruce McElay, McElay. My name is Tom Martin. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview. Good morning, Bruce. How are you today?
Well, good morning, Tom. I'm doing good, thanks.
Good. Bruce, may we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Of course you do.
Thank you very much. Last time we were talking in part 5 of, you had some stories, some interactions with Georgie White. And I should just add that in the 1940s, Georgie was living in California, and she ended up doing some hiking with Harry Aleson, A-L-E-S-O-N, and then some river running with Harry, hiking in at Parashant, and then in 1952, she rode a raft through Grand Canyon all the way through with Elgin Pierce, P-I-E-R-C-E. So she was one of the early river runners. And when did you first meet Georgie?
Well, I didn't know her that well and didn't spend a lot of time with her. I just knew her. I knew about some of her history, which is really interesting to me. And so one day, Canyoneers launches on Sunday, and I'm usually up at 4 in the morning before anyone else is, and it's dark. And I fiddle around with stuff until everyone else is up at around 5, 5:30, and then we really get started from there. Well, this one Sunday morning, I saw the silhouette of someone sitting on a big cooler right on the boat beach there in front of some big rafts. And so I went over there. I try to stay quiet in the morning because people are still sleeping. And so I go over there, and it's Georgie sitting on this big cooler with her legs crossed, drinking a Coors. I think it was Coors, drinking a beer. And so I said hello and asked if I'd sit down. I knew who she was. And so, sure, sit down, have a seat. And you want a beer? I said, no, ma'am, it's too early for me. And so I asked her about things. We're just talking about the river and running the river and things that happened down there. And I said, Georgie, I'd really like to hear your story about that time that you and your boatman friends ran Cataract Canyon at 125,000 cubic feet per second. And because I wanted to hear about that. I'd read about it some, you know, as part of our oral history that we tell people, you know, on the commercial trips. But I could hear it from, you know, firsthand. And so Georgie, she likes telling those stories. And she starts out, she says, well, you know, the average, they just don't know. They just don't know. And what she means by that, the average is just people that are not boatmen. And there's no way they could understand what that was. And I said, well, Georgie, I'm a boatman. You tell me. I want to hear about that. So they heard Cataract was running high. They wanted some excitement, so they rigged a motor rig, I don't know, 25, 30-foot long motor rig of some sort, launched and ran. And she said, it was just immediately dangerous. There was so much water flowing down through there that it was creating these giant whirlpools. And she said, you can't really see those things. They're flat on the water. You can't really see them till you're on them. And one of them caught her boat and sucked it down in, turned it straight up, and just violently, you know, hurled that thing out the top of the whirlpool. Bent the frame, broke some straps and what have you. It was a pretty hard hit, that whirlpool was. I've never seen anything that big myself. And she said we were able to pull over, and we had rope but not many straps, so they roped their frame back on as best they could, kept going. She said when they got down toward the bottom of it, these waves started showing up. She said they're 50-foot high waves. They're mostly on the side, not in the middle of the river. She said you couldn't go there. You just couldn't go in something that big. And I said, 50 foot, Georgie, are you sure about that? She says, I'm not exaggerating at all. They were 50 foot high, crashing waves from those big boulders on the side of the river. And she said, we were fearful. We couldn't pull over once we got into that. We had to keep going. And anyway, it was a wild, rough ride, apparently. And her comment was, she said, it startled us, and I'll never do that again. I don't know. That's a lot of water. I don't know how you run it at 125,000. It would just be so dangerous. But anyway, it was that. We'd sit down and talk about things like that, and then come about 5:30. It was time to get to work, and we'd part company. And then she was on every other week launch, and we were on every Sunday to launch. And so I saw her for about a month or so. Every other week, I'd be up at 4, and her and I'd sit down on that cooler in the dark, just telling stories about stuff.
Fun. This was 1983 or 82, 84-ish, remember the year on this?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
82 is my first year. 83 would have been one of those years.
Okay.
I don't remember which one, but and then you know, Georgia and I were friends. We'd see each other on the river sometimes at Deer Creek or something. We'd sit down and talk on the boats, and I just enjoyed her. And later on, some years later, when I started doing the solo trips, just a few years later. I was parked at down below Diamond at Travertine or Travertine Falls or something. At any rate, I was sitting there, and Georgie came roaring up with one of her big rigs, and she was by herself. There was nobody on the boat. She was just going full speed ahead, just fast that boat to go, and I waved at her, and because she'd pull over if she sees me. And I waved at her and smiled, and she looked over at me, didn't take her hand off the tiller, nothing, just turned her head back straight, and kept on motoring down the river. I thought, God, did I do something to make her mad, or what's going on here? Well, what was going on was they flipped the boat in upset, I think, and they couldn't get the count right, so one of her boatmen apparently swam under the boat to find the missing person and was drowned. And she was driving her boat out after the incident. I could be wrong on those details about where, another commercial company came down. They were deadheading on out. They dropped everybody off at Diamond and were deadheading, and they pulled over and told me that something had happened with Georgie, and she lost one of her boatmen. And wow. I thought, oh, my God, that's horrible. That's the worst. That's it. It's the worst news I could hear. I was crushed, and I thought, oh, Georgie, man, I'm so sorry. But that's it. That's pretty much the last time Georgie and I really saw each other. I was not running commercially anymore, and really didn't see her much after that. But that's my little bit of Georgie story.
What else would you guys talk about there on the cooler?
We're just talking about going down the river. She knew Gaylord, and she knew all the old-time river runners, and she'd tell me about people. I don't remember much details. It was just kind of fun hearing about the old days, you know?
Okay.
And just small talk. We talk about how we rig our boats and how they run through the rapids and how all the different boats handle so differently. And you might drive one, but you might not be able to drive the other until you learned how to run it, because they don't act the same at all. I'd never really thought about that, because I've only ever driven the one big boat. Didn't know anything else. Just, you know, things like that.
Okay.
Really not that much. Just that I just remember her driving by that one day. She was just so, she seemed real upset. Mm. That's when there was a reason for it. I just didn't know.
Sure, yeah.
Does that sound right? Did she have a wreck at upset and lose a boatman?
You know, I can't say for sure. I haven't researched into that yet, but I can't say. I know that.
I think that
she had a fatality in Crystal, but that would have been was that 83?
Maybe that's where it was. Maybe that's where it was.
This
you'll know the details of that better than me, because I don't have any way to research it. But I've always enjoyed her company. She was interesting and easy going, always nice to me. I enjoyed her company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that she wrecked a lot of boats, but I never brought that up, of course.
How is it? How do you say that? Was that stuff you had heard, or did you see things like that?
No, I never saw them have any trouble, really.
Uh-huh.
One day I pulled them off a rock with my rope puller, but it was a low water day or something. I don't remember. Yeah, it was. It was running one of those research flows running 8,000. She got stuck in MNA rapid.
Oh, my. Okay. Oh, gosh.
Real rocky mess in there. And they kind of got hung up, and I was able to pull them off with my rope puller. That's about it. You know, that's about the most I ran into her.
Then she was running her elephant rig there, the triple donuts tied together.
No, not that day. She knew she couldn't run Grand Canyon with that big triple rig if the water went below. I think about. It seemed like her cutoff was 16,000. Below that, she knew she was going to have trouble. So she had smaller boats.
Okay.
She'd run, and that was what I ran into that day. Man, MNA, it's not a rapid, really. It's just a god darn rocky mess.
Right, it's a rockfall there that has peppered the river with boulders. And so at low water, those boulders, you have to weave and dodge through there. And it would be fairly simple still today, catching the occasional river runner there.
Well, it's caught me before. I don't know it. I don't see it enough to know how to, you know, pick my way through there. And some of those rocks, you know, you can't even tell. There's not enough current moving past them to show, you know, any waves. It's just sitting down there 6 inches under the water, and it'll grab you. Like, oh man.
So were you on a Canyoneers trip, or was that on one of your solo trips that you ran into her there?
Solo. It was one of my solo trips.
And you had your rope puller, which was neat.
Yeah, I did. I use that more for other people than myself, as it turns out. But it's a handy thing to have. Mm. Somebody ran up on a rock. Somebody lost their motor at 24 or 24 and a half. And at that time, I was on a summer solo, and they just, you know, real easy ran up on the rock on river left there. I mean, straight up it, too. The passengers all came off the top of the boat and walked across the top of that rock down to the beach.
Huh.
And I said, well, boys, I got this gadget here. They said, well, what do you got? I said, that's a rope puller. I said, well, I said, I think we need to pull you off the same way you went on there. That's what makes sense. They said, yeah, but how are you going to do it? So go upstream and just start yanking,
uh-huh.
See what happens. They weren't up there. They weren't stuck that hard.
Hmm.
You know, they were just
uh-huh.
kind of stuck a little. And boat was standing pretty much straight up, too, or 45-degree angle.
Hmm.
It was dramatic looking. So anyway, it took about an hour and got some rope long enough, got some bowlines and stuff. And roped up to it, found a rock that we could tie to, and started cranking. Came off of there an inch at a time, you know, till the motor could, you know, get a grab. Then gravity pulled it on off.
Cool. Cool.
No problem. Took a while, but well, they weren't bad stuck. So anyway, I'd use that gadget for that. Seemed like once in a while.
Nice.
Come in handy. Mostly for motor rigs. That's what it. What I ended up using it for, I had it for myself, but mostly motor rigs.
Huh.
Actually, I did use it one time. I got stuck high on the beach because I let my pants down, didn't think, and the tide got me.
Ah.
And I was able to get out in the water and put an anchor in and started yanking my dragging my boat back into the water.
Huh, nice.
Well, I guess I was mad about it, and I was like, oh, man, it cost me an extra hour, then the sun's on the beach, and it's in the morning, and I was like, I got to get out of here, man. It's getting hot already.
So
anyway, I did, but it took an hour. I took an hour out of my day.
Not bad.
Better than a day out of my day.
Exactly.
If I had to wait for the tide to come in, then I could have got off.
Right.
So anyway, there was a couple of events I should probably tell you about. That one of them, I've never told this to anyone, not my wife, anyone. And it's not that it's secret or sacred or anything. It's just I don't know how to tell you. I don't know how to tell you. It's just so different, but. One day I wanted to see the river from up above, just look down on it, get the, you know, the big picture, because once I'm on the river, I don't get that. So I went to South Rim and got out of my car and was walking to the rim, and I'm greeted with the smell of belching diesel from all these tour buses and people speaking in tongues, and it's crowded and smelly, and finally got to the South Rim to look over, but it wasn't very satisfying. I don't feel very well when I go there when it's that crowded. So I thought, you know, I know of a place, and nobody really knows about this. There's a road that takes off from a little bit, you go a little bit south on the main road into Grand Canyon Park there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a road that goes through a couple miles of the park, and then it gets into National Forest and BLM, then it finally ends up on Hualapai land, and it parallels the South Rim.
Uh-huh.
And it's a four-wheel drive road. And so I thought, I'm going down there. So I got in my truck and drove hard down that, about 20 miles down that road, and got to a really beautiful place, but the updrafts are just, oh man, they're blowing hard. It's in the afternoon, and there's no guardrails or anything out there. So I just kind of crawled to the edge there and looked down, straight cliff walls, straight down. And it's really pretty, but it's just drying my eyes out. The updrafts are so bad, and I looked down there and I saw something. There was a bird way below me, big bird. And it had its wings outstretched, and it was coming up fast on those thermals, man. I went, holy man, what's that? And, man, here it came, whoosh, right by me and a couple hundred foot up into the air and on that updraft. And it was a bald eagle.
Hmm.
It was playing the thermals. So I crawled back away from the rim. I wanted to watch it. And anyway, I got away from the rim, and the bird, he's out of the thermals, and he came and he made a pass right over my head.
Wow.
And I turned around and watched it, and it flew on down, got some altitude, came back, and made a pass over my head again the other way. And I went, what's going on here? Well, there's no high rocks or trees in the area, and I thought to myself, maybe it's looking for a perch. So it had gone down the other way, and so I stood there with my arms extended like a scarecrow and stood there to see what it was going to do. And it flew over my head again, but this time I didn't turn around. I was just going to stand there. And a few seconds later, I got hit with a jolt. It just almost knocked me over. This bird landed on my forearm, and as it did, it dug its talons into the flesh of my forearm, and the pain was just overwhelming. And I can't look at it because I know if I look at the bird, it'll be gone. And blood began to dribble down my arm, down my torso to my belt, and I can't, and I'm just, God, this hurts. And each time, we're both trying to stay balanced, and each time we move, its talons dig into my flesh further, and it hurts. So finally, I can't stand it anymore, and it's heavy. This eagle is heavy on my arm. And so I look over. I want to look at it, and I know it's going to fly. And I look at it. Its head cocks around, turns, and looks at me. It turns around straight ahead. It squats, jumps off of my arm, and takes flight. And disappears.
Wow.
This is a dream, Tom.
Hmm.
This is one of my Grand Canyon dreams. And I thought, oh my God, what was that all about? What was that? And so the canyon is pretty overwhelming. It takes all of your senses to appreciate it. It even permeates your mind when you're asleep in the way of dreams. And I'm susceptible to it. I dream of the place while I'm down there.
Hmm.
And there's this one dream I have to try and tell you about. One night I'm asleep and a symphony plays in my head, a symphony orchestra is playing the Symphony of Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And it's beautiful. It is spectacular. And when I wake up, I can't recall a single note of it. I only know that it was there. And this happened first time. Oh, I can't remember where it was. Oh, there was something I forgot to tell you on that eagle business.
Hmm.
When the eagle flew away, I dropped my arms down to my side, and then I couldn't move my arms or my legs, and I feel like I'm suffocating. I'm panicking because I can't move, and I wake up, and I'm tangled up in my mummy sleeping bag, and that's why I felt trapped. And when I unwound myself, I realized that it was just a dream. And I'm in the Grand Canyon, and this is night one. And so I get out of my sleeping bag, and it's like, my God, let angel trumpets sing. I'm in the Grand Canyon, and I'm on a solo raft trip.
Wow.
But I don't know what to make of that dream.
Have you been able to interpret that dream since then? Has it made sense to you as you've lived your life then after that?
A bit, and I'll tell you about it. Let me get through this second one,
okay.
And I'll tell you about that interpretation of it. So anyway, each time I get below Lava Falls, without fail, I don't know when or where, but I will have the dream. And the symphony that played on the first solo trip plays through with a new movement on the next trip, and a new movement on the next trip. And after about four or five solo trips, the symphony begins creating the orchestra creates new instruments, new sounds, new music that could never be heard because those instruments do not exist except in my dream. And they carry on, and to this day I now expect to hear my Grand Canyon Symphony sometime below Lava Falls with a new movement.
Oh, fun.
There will be a new movement there. And the problem, and I'm a musician. I study music. I play it. I sometimes write music. But I can't write a note of this because it is just beyond that, and I can't remember it. I can't remember the notes from it.
Mm.
I try, but I can't. So it is only in my mind. And as time goes on with this symphony, it becomes a language that is just as clear as you and I speaking to each other right now. I understand the language of Grand Canyon in this symphony. It speaks to me through the music in a language that I understand, like human speech. It's and that's why I've never told anyone because how do you explain that? It doesn't
right.
So anyway, I did. There's a friend of mine, a friend of the family, is a psychiatrist. He's written books on dream interpretation, and he loves to hear about my dreams.
Uh-huh.
So I told him of the eagle landing on my forearm, and I told him of the symphony, and I told him of one other dream, which I'll tell you this one, then the whole thing will make sense with the psychiatrist.
Okay.
But I had yet another dream. It wasn't in Grand Canyon. It had a little bit to do with it. But I was doing a show of my photography at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and they gave me a room to hang my photographs, and it's a purely political show. The photographs were of beautiful places that dams have destroyed.
Mm.
And so they were hung in pairs. One photograph was the dam, the destroyer, and the other photograph was the beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a McDonald's cup of tea or something I'd finished, and it was empty. And so I looked at the show, I hung it, and hung all of the dual pictures up of about seven or eight different dams, and something seemed missing. I had never seen all of my photographs of all the dams and all the beautiful places hanging at one time. I had never done it myself.
Hmm.
And I was just so mad about it, so upset that these beautiful places were gone, and there's one more thing. I can do one more thing that will get my point across here. So I took a razor blade, and I made a small slit in my wrist, and I filled the cup with blood. And when the cup was full, I stood in the middle of the room, and I spun around quickly, and it splattered blood all over the walls and all over the photographs. Just a spattering of blood here and there on everything. And then I thought, okay, I'm happy. That's what I mean to say. And I left. Show's ready to see, whoever wants to go see it. And so I told these to the psychiatrist guy, and he was like, oh man, those are wild dreams. And so his interpretation of those two dreams, the dream of the eagle on my forearm with the blood running down my waist, and then the museum show, he said the meaning of those is that you are so passionate about this place that you will spill your own blood to be there. And I thought, you're right. I will.
Hmm.
I'll do anything to be there. There's nothing more important in life than for me to be on that river in Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
And he's probably correct that I will do most anything. The blood is just symbolic of the fact that he thinks that I will do whatever is necessary in life in order to be down there. And I think about shooting photographs. Is it because I want to see the photographs, or do I want other people to see the photographs? And after many trips down there, I've decided that it's neither of those things. The reason that I shoot photographs is because it forces me to pay much closer attention to places in the Grand Canyon that I wouldn't normally notice, maybe not even notice at all. But if I'm shooting a picture of it, I'm watching it very intently.
Hmm.
I'm looking at the light. I'm looking at the time of day. I'm watching it change moment by moment and deciding exactly when it is that I'm going to shoot that picture. And so I'm looking at this piece of Grand Canyon very closely and over a period of time. And normally I don't do that. I'm busy with other things. And I think that is the deep down reason that I shoot photographs down there? Is it because it brings me closer to the Grand Canyon? I can't seem to get close enough to it, no matter what I do. But I think the photographs are one way that I try to do that. So anyway, that's my dream.
So I'm curious because, you know, two of these dreams really seem to be talking about your life, I mean, your life's blood, the desire to be there and connect with this place that your photography allows you. The second dream is interesting. It almost seems like it's more of the canyon talking to you or trying to communicate back to you. Is that how you see that?
Yes. Okay. The canyon is an inanimate place. It's not like a human. Hmm. It's a different being, but it's alive in its own way.
Hmm.
And I just want to communicate with it, and I do so when I'm awake by looking around at things and enjoying the place, try to get down there without killing myself.
Right.
And I do it in my sleep, apparently. It communicates with me in my sleep.
Hmm.
It's bizarre. It's just, but the dreams are pretty bizarre, so mm-hmm. I guess that's mm-hmm. anything new. And I don't feel badly about those. I mean, they don't make me hurt. They make me think. That's what they do. And the continuing dream, the symphony, I look forward to that. Every time I look forward to what's going to be the new movement or what's going to be the new instrument that my mind invents to play this new movement.
Nice.
I look forward to it. It's there, and I know it will come because it has for 10 trips. It's been there every trip.
Hmm.
Odd. And I don't tell people, but I don't, this is the first time, except for the psychiatrist, that I've told this to anyone, and it may be the last. I don't know.
Well, it would be really wonderful if you found the ability to actually try to convert that symphony to
put it on paper, yeah.
To a human paper there someday. So
I know how. I have rudimentary skills that I can write music.
Mm-hmm.
I know the notes, the scales, the everything. I know that. I studied that in college. That was my minor. I just can't do it, Tom.
Huh.
I tried. I just can't get the notes on paper. They're not there. They're only there in my dream, in my sleep.
Hmm.
Maybe one day somebody like you will invent an instrument that interprets people's dreams while they're asleep.
It won't be coming from me, that's for sure. Interesting. I'm just curious to hear more of your solo stories.
Let me give you one from someone else's perspective.
Okay.
A friend of mine is a technical writer. She's a professional author. She writes for universities for grant writing, and she writes for big corporations, you know, their annual stockholder meetings and annual report statements and whatnot. She's very good, apparently. And so anyway, I told her about Grand Canyon, and she's just fascinated. She's never heard of anything like this. And so she wrote something after a couple of years of hearing about all of this. She wrote a kind of a poem and gave it to me.
Hmm.
And I like to read it for you.
Please.
Because I think it's pretty good. Anyway, her name is Lisa LaMole.
How do you spell Lisa's last name?
LeMole.
Thank you.
LaMole. So her poem starts, the title of it is Mistress of the Canyon. Excuse me. She is a mistress, this canyon of yours. You long for her sweet smell and languid curves that belie her nature. She makes you wait to gain your strength. No ordinary lover will she have, for she will take the best of you. She is a lover, a vixen, a temptress that you cannot refuse. She knows your hand, so steady, so familiar on her face, she almost sleeps. You have mapped her body and studied her depths, and yet each time with her will be exactly like the first, dangerous and uncharted. She is a river. She is an ocean. She is a goddess, and you are her constant companion. All the secrets that are shared upon that bed of rolling current are kept between the walls, between the veil of dawn and dusk, a tryst, a turn, a little death. And she, the fairest of them all, may bring you to your knees and make you gasp for air. But you will thank her once again for feeling life so dear. And that's it.
Wow, very nice.
It is. It's beautiful. So anyway, I wish I could write. Some people can. I'm not one of them.
Hmm. Well, you write with your photographs.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Everybody.
So that's really the only things I didn't want to miss was her poem, which I really like, and then the dreams. So what else you want to pick up with here, Tom?
Oh, I was just wondering about other you know, experiences that you had on your solo journeys. Photographs
animals,
that happened or didn't happen. Yeah, animals.
The animals, the creatures down there, they keep their distance pretty much because most river trips have got a little bit of noise going, and the rigs make noise, the motor rigs make noise, people talking. But if you're down there alone and you stay quiet, the animals come in. They're curious, and they'll come in to you. So one day I was on a beach down near 220, down way down there, and I don't like camping on River Wright because that's where everybody else camps, and it's full of ants, and I don't like. So I'm camping across the street on River Left, and I'm sitting there not doing much, and then I hear a noise, and I turn around, and it's a big old bighorn, big rack, the elder, and he's looking around, you know. So I just sat there, didn't move, and pretty soon the whole crowd comes down to the beach. They have a big party down there. There's the big bulls, and then the women, the females, are running around, and the little babies, they're playing in the sand on the beach. And pretty soon a couple of the big ones square off and do the whole headbutt thing.
Oh, wow.
And let me tell you, I'd not been that close to it before, but when they hit, it will hurt your ears. It's so loud. It's a crack, man.
Mm-hmm.
And they did this a few times, just whack. Unbelievable loud sound. And they all kind of went down the water and got a drink and played around on the beach for a bit. And then they began walking away, and pretty soon they were gone, just like that.
Mm.
But I've never had that. Never had them come down to my beach on a group trip.
Right.
Never seen that. And then another thing I saw in Specter Chasm, I'd heard stories about the elusive pure white bighorn sheep.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, man, is that just rumor, or was that just folklore? Probably. So anyway, I'm going down Specter Chasm. I think it's maybe the drainage for Fishtail or something else right in there, right at the top of Specter Chasm. And I know the beach where, there's a beach where they come down. And so I'm always looking over there. And this one day, there it was. There it was, a white desert bighorn sheep.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. And so I struggled to get, I couldn't get over to that side, so I pulled over River Right. This was on River Left. And I pulled over, and now I'm pretty far away, but I got my binoculars out, and I looked at them. There was about five of them had come down to the water. And it was just gorgeous.
Hmm.
It was pure white, and it was not an albino. It didn't have a pink nose. It didn't have red eyes. It was just a regular bighorn that was white instead of buff. And they went away, and I went on downriver. And some years later, I saw it again. I saw another white bighorn sheep. So I was at Carlsbad National Park. We were doing a video for ESPN about something. And we were interviewing the superintendent, and between takes, I told him about, I asked him if he'd ever heard about these white desert bighorns before. He said, no, but that's something that you might see. And I said, well, how would that happen? He said, well, all of the animals have different colored, you know, they have different genes that will express different colors in their coat or in their makeup or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there's a, you know, for that animal, there's a white gene. There's, you could probably see a coal black one, and you'll see a buff one. And he said, the gene is there. And if it's expressed, then that's what you get, is a white one. Nature is always trying new things.
Okay.
It'll try a white desert bighorn, and if it doesn't work, it won't express itself very often. If it does work, the gene carries on and expresses itself, and that's what you get. So buff is the color that works best out west, and so that's what they are. Just makes sense. Just
this
evolution.
This was near fossil. So this is upstream of Specter, do you think?
It's at the beginning of Specter Chasm.
Okay.
On river left.
Yep.
And I don't. Fossil is up above, just a little bit above.
Yeah, there. A little ways up upstream of there, and there's that's a big area for bighorn, and in the 1990s, I remember seeing a white sheep in there a couple times.
You have seen it.
Yeah. No, it's been seen by folks, so it's in there. But I don't remember seeing it that far downstream. Is it, you get into the schist down there, and the Tapetes is kind of higher up, and so was it was it down on the delta then of the rapid? Because you can walk that.
Remember, I think Tapetes was down close.
Okay.
So it would have been above Specter.
All right, so that puts it right back in the same area. So, yeah, that would make sense. All right, cool. Huh, because I always assumed that it was an albino, but you've got some other data here that says, no, it could actually just be a white sheep.
It was a white sheep. I could tell. I had binoculars, and I could tell.
Hmm.
If it had eyes and pink feet, albinos also have pink skin. They're pretty distinctive. I know what an albino animal looks like, and this one just didn't fit. It was just white instead of buff. That's all.
Huh.
And I've loved to see it again. I always look, you know, kind of wait there. Maybe they'll come down. I'll wait a few minutes anyway, just to see. I'm always looking around that area with binoculars because there's bighorn in there, and I'm looking for that white one again. I desperately want to photograph it. I have not seen a photograph of those white sheep, and I'd like to get one. I'd like to get a photograph of one. Don't know if I ever will. Chances are not good. It's on my mind.
The lifetime of those sheep is so short. I'm sure that this one has passed, but
yes, you know, there
may be others. So,
well, it can be, apparently.
Yeah.
They've got the gene.
Yeah.
Mother Nature might just try it again, see what happens.
That's right, that's right.
see if the white one does any good. Let's see, what else on solo trips? The animals, I love that part. I think I told you about the deer and the red-tailed hawk. Or maybe it was an eagle.
Mm.
You remember that? Did we talk about that?
It doesn't ring a bell right now, but it doesn't mean that we haven't.
Well, it was up Marble Canyon, you know, real quiet, and on River Wright there was a shady area in the Tammies, and a big deer with a big rack, a big buck, was laying in the sand, just laying down, relaxing, and in front of him, 5 foot away from it, was a big red-tailed hawk.
You
just
did
standing
mention
there.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like I didn't know you guys were friends. But I guess they are. They don't threaten each other. So I guess they're friends. If they're not enemies, maybe they're friends. And things like that, endearing things like that come to you on a solo raft trip that never came to me on a group trip. Never. Never so intimate as that. And I really enjoy being close to the animals. There was a pair of raven that followed me for 3 straight days down the river. They'd stayed with me and hung around the beach they'd be with me for hours while I'm, getting ready, doing dinner, shooting a picture, whatever. They're right there playing around, hacking around, just having fun. And then they would leave. So I think they would fly up into the rocks at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd come down the next morning and we'd carry on. They'd land on the boat, they'd land on the raft once in a while as I'm going down river, and they'd go out ahead of me, and then they'd be back behind me, and they'd cross back and forth across the river. Then when I'd come into camp at night there, they'd be. Went on for 3 days.
Huh.
Same couple. And they weren't, begging for food. I mean, they'd take it if they could get it, of course, but they'd always try. Always try and scarf something if they can get it, but that didn't seem to be their motive. I think they were curious. And then another time there was a bird that followed me, and it never did leave the boat. It would sit on the boat all day long. And once in a while it would fly off over to the shore and then fly back, but mostly it would just stay on the boat and then come into camp at night, and it would either stay on the table. If it was too noisy there, it would go hang out on a rock. Don't know what kind of bird it was.
Huh? Big bird, little bird? How do you describe it?
Pretty big bird. I bet it was a pound and a half or two. Probably 10-12 inches tall. Kind of grayish. Had a funny, almost a kind of a ugly penguin. Not ugly, but kind of a fat penguin face. Maybe. I think I got a picture of it. You'll know what it is when you see it.
Yeah, it'd be fun to see a photo of it.
Yeah, I'll send you one of those. You want that and the Canyoneer flip pictures, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'll send you both when I get the darkroom going, which I'm close to that now. Finally.
Okay. All right. Fun.
So what else can you think?
Did you ever have the boat float away from you? Did you ever run into people and have interesting interactions with people, certainly in the winter? I mean, in the summer, there's a lot of people down there, and that's kind of a different deal, but in the winter.
I have had interactions. Yes. one in particular is very interesting. Peggy at the ferry said, there's another solo rafter out ahead of you. And I said, oh, tell me about it. She was kind of sheepish. She said, he may need some help. Oh, well, okay. If I see him, I'll see what he's up to. Anyway, first day I got down there, and he was over on the beach on River Left re-rigging his boat, which sometimes you do. I mean,
yeah.
You rig your boat as best you can. You get off into the current, and you go, oh, man, I didn't do that right. Pull over, take your boat apart, put it back together right, or the way you want it, and go on down the river. I've done that a time or two. So he's over there re-rigging his boat, and I pulled over, and curious man, and I said, well, why don't we camp down at Soap Creek? He goes, okay. So I got down there first. He came in. And he's a solo rafter, but he's a hiker is his big deal. He's a trans-canyon hiker. And the main reason he's rafting is so that he can leave food caches at various places so he can do his from start to finish on the south rim, start to finish on the north rim, that sort of thing.
So does he want to hike from Lee's Ferry to Pierce Ferry? Is he a through hiker, or does he simply want to hike rim to rim across the canyon?
ferry to ferry.
Okay, so he's doing the through hike is his intent. Okay.
Yes, I hadn't heard it called that. Yes, that's what he's doing. And he's a curious guy. He's not a boatman at all, and he's not very good at it as it turns out. Peggy was right. The guy needed some help. As it turns out, he is a real live rocket scientist. He works for somebody down in Tucson, a high tech company that builds rocket nose cones or something, and he's a physicist, a mathematical physicist kind of guy, and he designs rocket nose cones or something. His name is Bill. I remember his name. His name is Bill Kells. And so we kind of leapfrogged each other going down the river for the whole trip. Sometimes we'd camp together. We didn't try to or anything. I would just say, well, here's where I'm going today and this and that. I wanted to be with him at the Big Rapids for both of us, because, you know, at least one of us should get through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy, it's his second trip down Grand Canyon, and his first trip, apparently, he flipped it at 2:32 and got separated from his boat and mistakenly went to shore thinking his boat was going to come to him. I don't know. Well, his boat goes merrily on downstream, and
uh-huh.
sat there on the beach for many days, apparently, until somebody came by and gave him a ride down, and they found his upside-down boat many days later. But holy mackerel, that's pretty harrowing.
Yeah.
And then another time, he misjudged Harding, President Harding Rapid, the big boulder in the water there?
Yeah.
He missed it. He misjudged it. And it sucked his boat into the eddy behind it violently. It's a violent eddy back there. And it flipped his boat and sucked him under the water and pinned him on Harding Rock 10 feet under the water.
Wow.
So now he's looking up at this crystal clear water. His boat had washed away, and he's looking up through all this pretty water at the sky above him, but he can't breathe. And so he couldn't go up, so he knew to scramble down. And he scrambled down and finally caught current that was leaving the rock, that's what it does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he got deep enough, and it sucked him out and spit him out below the backwash, and then he swam over to his upside down boat.
Huh.
So that's Bill, man. He's not a real big time river runner. He's a hiker guy, and he uses that river trip, and he does it solo because he doesn't want anyone to know where his food cache is.
Ah.
So, on the days of his food cache, you know, we agree that I'm not going to be anywhere near him, and we're not going to camp together, so that
mm-hmm.
I can't know where his food cache is.
Okay.
Not that I care. It's for his peace of mind. And so we do that. We separate, and he does his food cache, and he catches back up with me again. And we run some rapids together, and we got through everything that we ran. And
okay.
But I lost him about... Oh, I lost him about Havasu area. Didn't see him again. And wondered whatever happened to that guy. He must have made it because I didn't see his boat wrapped around a rock anywhere. So.
What year was this? I'm kind of curious. Do you have a rough idea?
Bill Kells, the solo would have been, I'd been solo 6 or 7 maybe.
So
90s.
Yeah, mid-1990s.
I'd say, yeah.
Okay.
I'll check my notes that I took on that trip. I tell you exactly what day it is because I have a launch sheet that goes with it.
Did you guys did you stay in touch with him after that? Did you guys stay in touch?
Nope, never did. Okay. He was the antisocial type. He had a house on purpose that was so small. that visitors couldn't stay.
Hmm. Okay.
He didn't want visitors. So his way of getting around that was to have a house so small and so uncomfortable that no one would want to stay there.
And this was in Tucson.
That's just the way he was.
Okay.
And he'd drink three beers every night.
Okay.
First order of business was to grab a bucket of river water and put three beers in it. And this guy is, I've never seen anything like it, and it's kind of what you want to do if you're a solo rafter. Maybe this is how it should be done.
Hmm.
He carried 20 pounds of potatoes, 10 pounds of rice, and 20 pounds of cabbage.
Okay.
And that's all that he had. That's it. That was his entire food source for the river trip down Grand Canyon, was three items that he would mix and match every night into something different, I guess.
So it would be potatoes with a little bit of rice and cabbage, or cabbage with a little bit of potatoes and rice, or rice with a little bit of potatoes and cabbage.
Oh, he had miso.
Okay.
He had a big slug of miso. So he would mix miso in with everything, and he turned me on to miso. I'd fed him some regular meals, and then he fed me what he ate sometimes. And the miso, that makes it palatable. I mean, it's not much of a menu, but it was very simple, and he didn't need much, and it doesn't take much to prepare for. And
right.
If you think about it, food is the most time-consuming part of a raft trip, easily. And he took that out of the equation. I mean, I got to hand it to him. It's a smart move.
Except all of that, potatoes, rice, and cabbage, I mean, it needs time to cook. You've got to get a fire or some sort of stove and fry or boil that stuff. Well, certainly the potatoes.
Well, but he didn't have to spend all of that time in preparation.
Hmm.
He'd go to the store an hour later. He has everything he needs for his river trip.
Right.
Well, that's pretty good, man. Takes me days and days. I can't do it. I've done it. I did it once. I went down. I know how to do it as a backpacker, right? So I think in my mind, okay, I'm treating this as if it were a backpacking trip into Grand Canyon, and I'm going to bring this food for the backpack trip. And I did that one year, and it was so boring and lifeless. I can do better than this. I'm not doing this anymore. And it still took me a while to prepare all that. So I thought, if I'm going to spend this kind of time on it, I'm going to have the best food I can have. And I'm still that way. Yes, I could have many more hours in the canyon if I did the Bill Kells menu, no doubt. But I'm not willing to sacrifice it.
I'm curious to know how he worked out his boat. Did he have a boat? Did he have a cataract boat like yours with the, you know, two tubes and a frame, or did he have a, you know, what?
He did.
Okay.
He had a cataract that he bought from a researcher whom you would know if I could recall the name.
Okay.
There was a researcher that had a cataract, a dark blue cataract, and he sold it to Bill Kells, and I don't know what he bought in favor of it, but anyway, he was a long-time researcher guy. He's been down there a million times. And I just love research. You can go down the river, just pluck a permit from the trees and go down the river 10 or 15 times to study a rock somewhere or a bird somewhere and just have a great big fun time and get paid big money for it. I mean, hey, it's great work if you can get it.
Hmm.
I could go on and on about research for a long time. I don't like running into them. I don't like what they do down there, and I disagree with what they do. And I stay away from them. I have made friends in the research business, and they're boatman friends, and I like them. I just don't approve of what they do, that's all.
Uh-huh. And there would have been a lot of that happening in the late 1980s, early 1990s for the turbine rewind of Glen Canyon Dam, and then a good amount of steady flow of science after that.
Oh, stupidly. It's crowded. Just, they're falling all over each other. So damn many research trips down there sometimes. A lot of them started running in the fall, I guess, because they were telling them, we don't want you taking up summer camp, so go down in the fall. And these guys would sit on a beach for weeks, you know, studying. What's that bird they were studying? Oh, they had to study that bird.
Well, they had a study.
Willow flycatcher.
Yep, there was
willow
also
flycatcher.
There was a study at Nakaweap, watching the bald eagles, and that was in the early 90s. And they had, you know, a station set up there at Nakaweap, and hike, climb up into the hills every day with binocs, and watch the eagles feed down there on the trout in the Nakaweap Creek.
Oh, isn't that amazing? A bird pulling a fish out of the water. No one's ever seen that before.
Uh-huh.
We've got to document that.
Mm.
That's important science, man.
Mm.
Yeah, and I ran into the owl researchers.
Oh.
I found fairly disagreeable. They were kind of snooty a little bit about what they were doing, and they had the right to be anywhere and do anything. They were studying owls back up in the Kanab Canyon.
Oh.
And I was doing a layover there. Kanab, there used to be a beach there. And Kanab was a place where I would lay over because I loved the hike, and I shoot pictures in there. And also, I would re-rig my boat for the rest of the trip and get it really good again, reorganize the food, reorganize the trash, you know, just kind of a day off to, you know, do some house cleaning, housekeeping. So anyway, the owl bunch pulled in there, and normally I'll double camp anybody, I don't care. But these guys, you know, I just didn't hit it off with them at all to begin with. It was just a confrontation from the start. And so I said, no, I'm fixing to take my boat apart, and this beach is going to be full of shrapnel, and there's not going to be room for both of us here. So no, I'm going to have to just let this double camp thing go this time. Man, that guy was furious. Absolutely furious about it, and they finally left. I think he thought about forcing his hand and camping there anyway, but they, in the end, they didn't do it, and that's the last time I ran into the spotted owl research group. So anymore, I have, for breakfast, I make sure I have the spotted owl omelet for breakfast. Just for those guys.
And you must have run into the fish people with their sport boats, nets, and lights in the night. And did you run into those groups at all?
What a travesty! I mean, that's breaking all the ridiculous. That's breaking all the rules badly. It was a lot of it was Brian on Brian Durker's trips. He loved that stuff, man.
Mm-hmm.
He loved his 50 horse little aluminum sport boat that go 100 miles an hour, uprun any known rapid. They love that stuff, man. But yes, they would come at night and shock and kill all the trout, and then scoop them up and put them into 55 gallon drums, and then they took them down to the Wallapai, who were supposed to have a fertilizer factory set up for all these dead trout. And so I said to one of them once, I said, well, I don't get it. I don't understand this. You're shocking, trying to get rid of these trout to make more room for the native fish, yet you know that the trout are going to repopulate this eddy completely within a couple of years. You know this, don't you? I said, yeah, well, we've got the money for the research, and we need to do the best we can for the native species. And I said, I don't see where you're going to help the natives here, pal. I'm sorry. So, of course, I'm right. The trout come right back in. And the biggest problem has yet to come. The big problem is going to be some eggs get through the penstocks up at that dam with the striped bass. If the striped bass get into the corridor, nothing survives except striped bass. That's all you'll have down there. They'll kill off the trout. So if you want to kill off the trout, send down the striped bass. They'll do it for you.
Yeah, apparently the striped bass have come up from Mead, and they're all the way up to Randy's Rock, but they don't like the turbidity, and the turbidity comes in from the Paria just below the dam. So there's this zone in there where there's enough turbidity that you have a better population of natives. It's a fascinating journey of the whole fish on fish and fish researchers.
Well, I hope so. I hope they don't get far up there. I always fish for them to see, you know, how far up I can catch one of those things.
Mm.
Just out of curiosity, how far up have they come?
Uh-huh.
But a friend of mine, you know, on the other end of the scale, a friend of mine was one of the original fish researchers down there. And he was at LCR, Little Colorado River, hoping to save the chubs and the flannel mouth suckers and a few other fish. His name was Dr. Chuck Minkley.
Uh-huh.
And he was the best of the chub researchers I've ever seen. This guy was a dedicated cat, and he was willing to sacrifice everything for those fish. And he did a great job of cataloging and doing things that would, you know, help keep those fish alive.
Hmm.
And they ran him out. He pretty much had a corner on the humpback chub research market. You know, others wanted to get in on it. The National Park Service wanted to send their research teams down, and Brian Durker and his bunch, I forget the name of that outfit, they have a name now, was something different back then.
Hmm.
What's the name of that research outfit and Flagstaff?
The Glen Canyon Environmental Studies?
Yeah, maybe that's it. They morphed into that from something else.
So then it was anyway. By the Bureau Rec for the rewinding of the turbines, and then the USGS got funding to do the monitoring and research center, the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center through the USGS, and BioWest had the contract.
BioWest, I remember them. Yeah.
For the fish studies.
I was down at Little Colorado, pulled in there one day, and hiked up there. And I found four different research trips on the ground at one time.
Hmm.
Now, how absurd is that? I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, you've got these people with nets pulling the same fish out of the water and cataloging it and or tagging it and or reading the existing tag on it. It's like, man, leave the fish alone.
Hmm.
You're gonna kill a certain amount of them just from overhandling them. I couldn't figure that out. Why do you need four humpback chub research teams on the ground at one time?
Hmm.
What is the point of that? I don't know the point of it, but it's out there.
Yeah.
So I don't have a real soft spot in my heart for research. There is some research, I think, that is useful. The research into the norovirus, I think, was timely and important work that needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Because this thing came up out of nowhere and was hurting people, and they needed to tie it down. And so that kind of research... If you think about it, Tom, of all of the hundreds and hundreds of research projects and the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent, taxpayer dollars mostly, to go down there and do research, the results of this research has very little benefit to the public at large, to the public that visits South Rim, or the public that runs the river in Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
It has no benefit. And so if it has no benefit to the resource or to the people that visit the resource, what is the point of doing the research? The point of it is that they're having fun doing something that's really cool, and they're getting paid money to do it. And it's that simple, I think. And it's kind of wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to see a little less of it. If you're going to do research down there, I think it needs to, at the very least, it needs to benefit the river running public, and after that, it needs to benefit the people that visit Grand Canyon in other ways, either hiking or visiting the rims or whatever. And then after that, it should benefit the population at large somehow or another. And if they can't do any of that, I don't think it should be done. That's all.
It is,
but what I say doesn't matter.
Well, it is interesting thinking about the ecology of the river corridor in Grand Canyon National Park below a dam, below actually a series of dams, going up the basin. Glen Canyon National Recreation Area was formed behind the impoundment of Glen Canyon Dam, and that dam has completely altered the ecological balance of the Colorado River in Grand Canyon. I think it makes sense to study that, and there's certainly funding for that from the Bureau of Reclamation, who makes money with the dam. It is an interesting question about how to manage a dam made for sediment retention, how to manage that dam for beach building. It's a really interesting question. All the ramifications of that to the fish and to the insects and to the birds and to the vegetation along the river corridor.
Well, the whole thing, you know, the changing of Grand Canyon, the ecology is dramatically, drastically changed, and sometimes for the better, most times for the worse. But the research is there for two reasons, for politics and money. It's not there to benefit the canyon, per se. Oh, yes, now we understand down to the tenth of an inch how much sand is lost from this particular beach over a five-year period of time, blah, blah, blah. Well, they can't really change that fact. All they can do is document it. They can change the operation of Glen Canyon Dam, and to a certain degree, they have done that. And there have been some improvements, certainly from when I began there. When I began there, we could see as little as 2,500 cubic feet per second, which we saw that once, all the way up to, at the time, they were running it from 4,000 typically to 35,000, 4 to 35.
Mm-hmm.
That's an unbelievable change in a river. So they did change that up. They ramp it slower now, which damages the beach less, and they don't ramp it as far as they used to. The range is way less, and so I think that was good. They probably knew they were going to have to do that, but they're going to keep paying money to continue with the research, of course, because if the research doesn't continue and there is still damage being done to rare species of whatever, then there's a chance that they could have to decommission that dam in order to save the species. And nobody wants that. At least nobody in that ilk wants that. So the way to forestall that, the way to keep that from happening, is to continue researching it. If the research is going on, you can't very well stop the operation of the dam, because then the research would become affected, and we might have not gotten results that we need to see.
Yeah.
So they just keep going on and on and on, and then it will never stop, because if it does stop, the dam operations would be in danger, and the best way to keep that going is to flog it to death with research. But no, I don't like them going up and downstream. It's not as bad as it used to be. I mean, I was down there at a time when I was pulling flagging and silooms off of every dang beach down there, because they were doing their research at night and stuff. And so they were hanging this stuff, and they wouldn't take it with them. They left their trash. And then they left these, and a different research project, but at one point they were doing aerial photogrammetry. And they had these giant aerial photogrammetry points which are just big giant tarps with an X on them, right? And they left them to rot in the canyon.
Mm. Yes.
This is major trash. This isn't like, you know, a cigarette butt or a piece of cellophane. This is major visual trash, and they left it. And so when I would run upon it, you know, it's already deteriorating,
mm-hmm.
and I take it apart. It's either roped or rocked to something, and I mm-hmm. take it apart. I roll it up, and I pick off all the silooms and all the flagging, the red ribbons, and I just, you know, I pick all that stuff out of the canyon and take it. And at the end of the trip, I drive to the South Rim, and I give it to the superintendent.
Mm.
And I say, sir, here is a bag of trash. It's not my trash, and I would really appreciate it if you could tell these guys to pick their own trash up.
Hmm.
And they would go, oh, man, I forget who it was. Arnberger maybe was one of them. And he said, yeah, this is not right. That's not correct. He said, where did you get this? I said, oh, I can tell you where one of the photogrammetry points was, or maybe two. I don't remember. I just pick them up when I see them. He says, yeah, well, they're not supposed to be down there. They really should have picked them up. I said, okay, well, here, you show it to them. Send it to them in a letter. Tell them to quit doing that. So, anyway, I'm just not a big research fan.
Yeah, no, understood. It's an interesting issue with so many sides and different ways to look at it. And
well, how about this for research? Decommission the dam, let the water run through there, and then do some research.
Well, it's funny because if the dam was decommissioned, the amount of research would be really over the top. Yeah.
It would be, but at least I'd have the river back a bit.
That's right. Well,
not
all of
it. It could run high again. I mean, if Cat ran 150 one year, there's nothing to stop it.
No, that's interesting. Well, the historical hydrograph from the 1880s goes up to 300,000 cubic feet a second, and then what would happen? So,
well, the average just couldn't imagine that.
Mm.
As Georgie would say.
Yeah, yeah.
The average, they just don't know. 300,000 would be a fun thing to see. That's about all you could do with it is look at it. You couldn't run that. Well, maybe you could. I don't know.
It would be. I'm sure I'd certainly be willing to jump on board to try.
Yeah, I'd try it if I thought I wouldn't die. But, I don't know. That's a lot of water, man.
Mm.
A lot of water. Well, it would take out Glen Canyon. 300,000 hit the dam. I mean, and if it was high enough, it'd just run that thing right over. There was a scenario. The engineers had put together a scenario of a dam breach. In their estimation, hydrologically speaking, the narrowness of the canyon right there, the height of the dam, and et cetera, et cetera. They figured that if there was a dam breach, the flow would be at about 750,000 cubic feet per second until the lake drained. And then once that happened, the dams below there, I don't know, 7.5 hours later, Hoover goes, and then all the rest of them pop down below. So that down below the last dam, the flow rate was estimated to be 1.5 million cubic feet per second.
Hmm. Okay.
That's a lot of water, man. That's a lot of water. It would flood Imperial Valley 2 feet deep, and all of those folks that live on the river going down through Mexico, they were estimating that 30,000 people would have died had the dam breached.
Hmm. And the salt in the sea would fill. I mean, it's just interesting ramifications of...
Oh, it'd be fun to see.
The changes that would happen.
Not the 30,000. I'd like to get them out of there, but...
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we have been happily chatting about an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, crazy.
I'm just curious. Should we revisit with a part seven, or do you think we've pretty much covered what you'd like to cover here?
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't I read through my journals?
Okay.
And see if there's any other interesting stories that you might like, or some interesting things, and I'll let you know.
That sounds great.
If there's any more solo stuff to cover, we can. If there's not, let's just call it.
Okay. So with that, this will conclude part six, Oral History Interview with Bruce McAlay. Today is Tuesday, June 4th, 2019, and there may be a part seven, but there may be not. We're not sure about that. Does that sound like a plan?
That's good for me, sure.
All right, thanks, Bruce, and hold the line.
Thank you, Tom.